Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. Coming up on today's programs, ongoing protests in Hong Kong against Beijing, concern over the foreign media ban on Maurice Island, Khmer Rouge families find discovered photos. We have this and more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Protests have continued in Hong Kong against plans to teach Chinese patriotism in schools. Demonstrating before Sunday's parliamentary elections, the protesters say the new subject, to be made compulsory in 4 years' time, is aimed at brainwashing children by glorifying Communist Party rule. Critics of the new subject say Beijing is trying to cut short Hong Kong's democratic freedoms, as guaranteed in the One Country, Two Systems Agreement, guaranteed for 50 years in the 1997 handover from British rule. Sen Lam speaks to Emily Lau from Hong Kong's Legislative Council and the vice chair of the Hong Kong Democratic Party.
Well, we are very concerned that there has been an order from the central government in Beijing that there should be attempts to influence the young children to make them more patriotic and more supportive of the communist government in Beijing. I guess they feel that some young people in Hong Kong are rebellious, so they want to introduce a curriculum in the primary school so that they can influence them when they're very young. Some of the guidelines that have been published are quite horrific because it shows that they only are interested in glorifying the communist regime and saying how good it is, although it is a one-party state, because it has brought order and stability and prosperity to the country. By contrast, they said, in America, where they have election, things are very chaotic and completely not to the benefit of the people.
But Emily Lau, this is one might argue that this is just one subject. Why do you think it has triggered such a hostile response from both the Hong Kong public and particularly university students?
Well, I think it followed on a series of events in which the central government has interfered in the affairs of Hong Kong, giving the very firm impression that Beijing is very impatient with this one country, two systems, which is, of course, for 50 years, from 1997. And they do not want Hong Kong to enjoy a high degree of autonomy, expressing our views, demonstrating and shouting, and, you know, they don't like that.
Is there a sense by the people of Hong Kong that Beijing is trying to hasten this 50-year period to take Hong Kong back entirely and very quickly, instead of honouring its one country, two systems that should last for 50 years?
Exactly. There are more and more people who now think that one country, two system is almost dead because if we cannot have our autonomy, our freedoms and the rule of law, then Hong Kong will just be like any other Chinese city.
But Emily Lau, it might be argued that this is just one subject in the entire curriculum in primary school. So surely parents can teach their children what real democracy is in their own home.
But the parents don't want to send their kids to schools which do things that they absolutely abhor. Why do they want to do that? Some parents are talking about withdrawing the kids from the schools. Some are even talking about emigrating. And the irony is that the kids of senior government officials and top politicians are mainly in the West. Some of them go to school there at our expense. So we pay them all the money to send their kids overseas. But our kids have to be brainwashed in the schools here. That's why the people are furious.
How do you see this issue panning out? Because the government is quite, seems to be quite intent on introducing this compulsory subject by 2016.
Well, I don't know. I hope the government will be sensible
Do you think part of the problem is that the curriculum, apart from promoting one-party rule, perhaps also made the greatest omission that it ignored the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre and also glossed over the Cultural Revolution? Is that what's annoying the people of Hong Kong?
Exactly. It ignored all the big mistakes made by the Communist Party and just tried to glorify the party, saying what a great job it has done.
That was Sen Lam speaking to Emily Howe from Hong Kong's Legislative Council. She's also the vice chair of the Hong Kong Democratic Party. As Australia prepares to get its offshore processing centre on Papua New Guinea's Maurice Island up and running, yet another issue has raised concerns. PNG's Department of Foreign Affairs says it will not accept visa applications from foreign journalists wanting to visit the island. The move has sparked cries for greater transparency. We have this report from Helena Hoffman.
We just responded to the Foreign Affairs Minister, Honourable Ruben Pato, saying that the decision he made on behalf of the government is not a good decision. Because we are dealing with international refugees, therefore international media should be allowed to come and cover whatever stories that transpires out of this arrangement. It raises a lot of suspicion from a lot of Papua New Guineans, including us from the opposition, why the government is banning foreign medias. And one reason is Australia could be influencing the decision that the foreign minister has made.
Is there anything that might suggest that Australia has been involved?
We believe, or I believe, there is nothing for Papua New Guinea to hide. That is why I personally think that our government may have been influenced by Australian government to put a ban on foreign journalists.
Are you concerned that certain things might happen if the foreign journalists aren't allowed in, that there might be certain abuses of the system, for example?
Yes, I agree to that.
PNG's Foreign Minister Rimbink Pato is currently in the Cook Islands for the Pacific Islands Forum. Radio Australia has tried to contact him there for a comment on the foreign journalist ban, but has so far received no response. In a statement delivered to local media, Mr. Pato has simply said that the ban is temporary and necessary to prevent misreporting. PNG journalists are not affected by the ban. Titi Gabi from the PNG Media Workers Association says that makes the situation even more puzzling.
The explanation debate is just not satisfactory. It's just it's silly, to say the least. We've got nothing to hide. You know, they just make it look all so suspicious by introducing a ban. And we're trying to find out if that ban was endorsed by Cabinet. But when the matter was raised with the acting Prime Minister and Minister for Information, both were not aware of the ban.
Which is concerning in itself for you?
That is a concern that, you know, it just appears that a group of persons or just one person just get up and make a decision like that, which has its own backlash on us.
Is there any indication that Australian authorities might have put pressure for this kind of ban to be put through?
Well, that thought was sort of floated around, but there is no indication, there's no proof yet. I don't think Canberra would be that silly, but then you never know.
So would Australia have asked Papua New Guinea to put this ban on foreign journalists in place? A spokesperson for Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade told Radio Australia that they consider international media access to Manus Island a matter for the PNG government, and said that at no time has Australia sought to have a ban on media access. While PNG's government says it will ban foreign journalists from Manus Island, Nauru is taking a different approach. When I spoke to the Foreign Minister, Kieran Keke, he said they were keen to maintain transparency. He also said that during negotiations, Australia made no mention of how Nauru should handle media requests.
There's been several international journalists on Nauru over the last week, and there's more coming next week. We're not placing any restrictions on media travelling to Nauru. When residents are in place on the site, access will be limited more to protect the privacy of the individual asylum seekers.
And do you think it's important that some access is maintained, however, so that I guess there's a greater level of transparency?
Certainly. We have nothing to hide in this arrangement. And in fact, we want people to have the facts about how the centre is set up and how it's operating and the conditions that are being provided for asylum seekers.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. For thousands of Cambodians, the fate of their loved ones under the Khmer Rouge regime of the 1970s remains a mystery. The Documentation Center of Cambodia, or DCCAM, as it's often known, is an organization dedicated to collecting and researching documents from the Khmer Rouge period. From time to time, new documents and photographs emerge that provide people with information about how their loved ones and family members died. Claire Satterley reports.
Rexa Chuon was 8 years old when he last saw his father in 1976. For more than 30 years, he searched for answers about what happened to his father after he disappeared from Cambodia's Battambang province during the Khmer Rouge regime. Now he's come face to face with his father again in a photo.
They sent him by train to Phnom Penh around my family, the whole family. Only 3 days in the Phnom Penh, and he go, he leave family. So that time, the information finished. Until now, I found him in picture, not father. I'm very sorry.
The passport-sized black and white photograph is one of almost 1,500 recently donated to the Documentation Centre of Cambodia. Since 1995, DCCAM has been collecting and researching documents from the Khmer Rouge era. DCCAM director Yuk Chang says the latest donation is the largest ever collection from the Khmer Rouge's highest level security prison, Tul Sleng. A former government employee had been harbouring the pictures in her home for more than 20 years.
But I think that for so long she felt guilty that perhaps Ada might benefit from this photograph. So she decided to give to us without revealing her identity.
An estimated 14,000 people, most believed to be enemies of the state, were sent to Tul Sleng prison. There they were brutally tortured, interrogated and kept in desperate conditions before being sent to be executed on the killing fields. The regime kept extensive records during its time in power, and on arrival at Tul Sleng, prisoners were photographed and made to give their biographies. Only about 5,000 of these photographic portraits are known to have survived. Yuk Chang says the photos reveal the extent of the regime's paranoia and ruthlessness.
Look at this woman. They even call her grandma, but they kill her. You know, in the name tag, it's called Grandma Song. They even call, address her as a grandma, but they kill their own grandma, the Khmer Rouge. And this is horrible. I mean, had I one of her grandchild looking at this photograph, I can get very emotional. How could she be a CIA? You know, she's like, what, 78 years old?
Hundreds of children and the elderly were imprisoned at Tul Sleng, as well as many of Cambodia's educated and professional classes, including Rexa Chuon's father, a doctor.
I'm very sorry with my father that injustice for him, very injustice for him. He is the medical doctor, not in politics.
Rexa Chuon didn't know what had happened to his father until earlier this year, when an old family friend revealed that he had been sent to Tul Sleng prison. But he was misled because his father's name was incorrectly listed on prison records. He was only able to piece together the puzzle when a photograph was discovered in the latest donation. Details handwritten on the back of the portrait reveal his father, Heng Chuon, was arrested on the 21st of February 1976 and killed on the 22nd of May that year. He was 37 years old.
I feel very sorry and very glad when I see his face again.
Yuk Chang says the photos will help provide answers to some of the thousands of Cambodians who regularly contact DCCAM looking for information about their loved ones.
Every month, we always receive a request from people abroad, also from Cambodia living in the countryside. And we got very frustrated because most photographs, no name, and we cannot tell.
For Rexa Chuon, his almost lifelong search is now over.
The approved sale of a spawning Australian cotton farm, Cubby Station, to Chinese interest has sparked a political row. Australian National Senate leader Barnaby Joyce has described the sale as a disgrace, and he wants it to be stopped. But the Treasurer says the deal has saved many jobs, and without the foreign investor, the country's biggest farm may no longer be viable. We have this report from John Stewart.
Cubby Station rolls across 93,000 hectares in southern Queensland. It's one of the biggest farms in the southern hemisphere and can soak up more than 500,000 megalitres of water. Years of drought took its toll on the huge cotton and wheat property, and in 2009 the station was placed into voluntary administration with debts of $300 million. Last week, the federal government announced that 80% of the station would be sold to a Chinese-dominated consortium, Shandong Ruyi. National Senator Barnaby Joyce says the sale is a disgrace.
If we don't think the ownership of primary agricultural land is in our nation's interests, if we don't think an organisation that produces up to 13% of our nation's cotton crop is in our national interest, Mr Swan, what on earth is in our national interest?
Senator Joyce says that Cubby Station is Australia's biggest water licence holder and that farmers further downstream in the Murray-Darling Basin will have to negotiate with the new Chinese owners to keep their share of water. And he says it's unclear who will actually run the station.
We've applied to the Parliamentary Library and we cannot get any transparency as to actually who is the owner of Shandong Ruyi. What we do know is the CEO is appointed by the Chinese Politburo. What we do know is that state-owned enterprises are both the subsidiaries and part owners of this organisation. What we don't know is exactly who's behind it.
Senator Joyce's stance has put him at odds with Queensland's State Development Minister.
We should be welcoming foreign investment. There should be safeguards built around it. And from what I've seen of this particular exercise, there are safeguards in place.
The federal government says the remaining 20% of Cubby Station will be owned by an Australian wool processor, and the new Chinese investors have agreed that the Australians will operate the property. Shandong Ruyi has also agreed to sell down their initial 80% stake to no more than 51% within 3 years of the purchase. The federal treasurer stands by the deal and says the Chinese investment has saved 170 jobs and provided vital economic investment in the St George region, the home base of Senator Joyce. Wayne Swan tweeted to Senator Joyce, "I'll always stand up for Aussie jobs, unlike your mob during the GFC." Professor of Chinese Business at Sydney University, Hans Henrisk, says it's unlikely the government in Beijing will have any real control over Cubby Station.
The Chinese government itself is divesting itself of their own state-owned enterprises because they know they cannot run them. So there's quite a few good examples of Chinese investors in Australia where they bring in their top people and people who are highly qualified to run commercial ventures.
The opposition leader is not opposed to the deal and says the Foreign Investment Review Board has had a close look at it.
They would have looked at what investment the Chinese are bringing in, what improvements the Chinese intend to make. Are the Chinese going to be an active contributor to the local economy?
The National Farmers Federation want a land register created to bring greater transparency to ownership, but says as long as the Chinese company does not disadvantage Australian cotton growers, the deal has its benefits.
We need to be clear about the fact that there is an Australian company in there, so it's not wholly and solely owned by foreigners. There's certainly an Australian company there, and my understanding is that Lempriere are going to have a major say in the management of that, and they're going to employ a lot of the local people, continuation of that staff. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see where the debate ends up.
Senator Joyce says it's not too late to stop the deal going ahead and that Australian farmers can still be given the opportunity to manage the country's biggest cotton station.
If the Americans put a man on the moon, we can subdivide land. If we subdivided the land and we sold it off, we'd be able to reduce the price so that Australian farmers would get the opportunity to buy this country.
The final decision on approving the owners rests with Cubby Station's administrators.
Recently, it was announced that more than 1,100 names are being removed from Burma's notorious immigration blacklist. The list includes dozens of journalists, human rights activists, and others once deemed a threat by the authorities in the country. How many people remain on the list is unknown, but the government has suggested that more people will be removed soon. Radio Australia's Richard Erwart speaks to Daniel Ang, an elected member of the Burmese parliament, and Teddy Buri, the former minister of Burma's government in exile.
I welcome the president's, you know, action. Anything is good because he is opening the right wing and going the right directions, I think.
Now,
so,
you left Burma back in 1995, even though you were an elected MP. I mean, have you contemplated trying to go back between now and then, or was it something that just wasn't worth the risk?
No. I think we can go now, but since 1994, I left Rangoon in 1994, April. Soon after the adjournment of National Convention, and came over to the border headquarters of the Karen National Union there. A lot of my colleagues were there at the time. So I came to Manipla. Have you heard Manipla before?
No.
Yes. And after Manipla had fallen to the hand of the Burmese military operation, I came out and went to the Thai embassy, the Australian embassy in Bangkok, and then I contacted them, and I saw the political asylum, and I was allowed, and I arrived in Australia in December 1995. Since then, I never go to Burma, but during the next two decades, I joined the MPU. That, yes, as you know, we lobby for the country for more than two decades, I think.
Okay, but I mean, plainly, it was a remarkable journey that you undertook. We're joined also now on the line by Teddy Bury, who left Burma around about the same time as yourself in 1994.
Yeah, yeah.
He joined Burma's government in exile. Teddy, thank you for joining us on Connect Asia.
Welcome.
So your experience of leaving Burma, was it a similarly arduous journey that you had to undertake once you realized that essentially you were no longer welcome in your own country?
It was about the same, I think, under this, about the same circumstances. And it's been about 19 years since I've been away from my country, from my family. And it's naturally, you know, you feel good, you know, to know that your name is off the blacklist. And matter of fact speaking, we never belonged there because we were not criminals. And the fact that you're off the list and also you're able to go home, you know, makes you feel good. And also, you know, a big number of Burmese diaspora will be able to go back to Burma to contribute to the nation building, which is, I think, would be beneficial to the country, to the government, well, and, you know, to the returnees itself, themselves, you know.
Can I ask, though, that as and when I presume you make the journey back to Burma, which you're now free to do, will you in any way feel a little bit nervous, a little bit apprehensive about what may await you when you get there? I mean, essentially, do you trust the government?
Well, I think you're right when you mention the word, you know, nervous. You know, it's been 19 years and you don't really know what Burma is like there. You know, we might feel kind of a stranger there, and you don't know people there, you know. I mean, the fact that you're off the blacklist doesn't mean that the situation there, you know, is not irreversible. I think Burma has a long way to go, despite, you know, the reforms that has been put in place by Thein Sein government. I think it needs to go on a faster pace, and particularly, you know, in the arena political arena. You know, we have the ethnic armed groups, about 2,000 armed groups, signed, you know, have signed ceasefire with the military, or rather with the Tenzin government. But despite the fact that they've been calling for political talks, which we've been doing the same over the years, you know, there hasn't been any political talk. So, you know, that kind of, you know, one of the reasons that is going to make you kind of nervous when, you know, once you go home.
Teddy Bury, the foreign minister of Burma's government in exile, and Daniel Ung, an elected Burmese MP, speaking with Radio Australia's Richard Erwart. And guess what? We are now out of time. But before we go, once again, if you want to contact us with your stories or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. We now have a new email address for the program, and it's very simple. focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. You can also listen to this program again by going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Once again, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. So on behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Powell wishing you well, hoping that you'll join us again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye, everyone.